76 years ago yesterday, on a snowy afternoon in New York, a tall, handsome young man walked onto the stage of Aeolian Hall. He sat down at a grand piano and nodded toward the conductor. The conductor gave a downbeat, and the upward swoop of a solo clarinet filled the hall. The young man was George Gershwin, the conductor was Paul Whiteman, and the occasion was the world premiere of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. As part of our series on NPR's most important American musical works of the 20th century, Jeff London has this report on the story behind George Gershwin's masterpiece.
We now think of Rhapsody in Blue and George Gershwin as cultural icons, towering symbols of the jazz age as much as F. Scott Fitzgerald's Fiction or Babe Ruth's Home Run Trot. But on February 12, 1924, George Gershwin was known, if he was known at all, as a promising young songwriter. Nobody expected the 15-minute piece he wrote for Whiteman's Experiment in Modern Music would become a staple of the orchestral repertoire. In fact, according to musical theater historian Robert Kimball, Rhapsody in Blue was Gershwin's big break.
It really was his moment when he reached a lot of people, particularly in the symphonic world. I mean, in the pop music world, who knows? He would have had a really distinguished career, but this changed everything for him.
What made Rhapsody in Blue so striking, then and now, was its fusion of musical elements, classical, Tin Pan Alley, and jazz. In many ways, Gershwin was the first crossover artist, Robert Kimball.
More than any other composer in this century, he broke down barriers that exist between art and vernacular music, between so-called serious listeners and listeners who revel in pop and jazz. And he made it all part and parcel of the same thing, all part of a world.
Gershwin came from the world of New York's Lower East Side. Born in 1898, he was the son of Russian Jewish immigrants and showed little interest in music as a child. But as he grew older, he found himself captivated by a friend's player piano and taught himself how to play by mimicking the motion of the keys. Soon, he was seriously studying the music of Chopin and Liszt, but Gershwin found himself equally intrigued by the popular songs of Tin Pan Alley. When he was 16 years old, he quit school and got a job as a piano pounder at Jerome H. Remick & Company, a music publisher. Gershwin biographer Edward Jablonski explains.
A pounder was a guy who demonstrated at the piano, so dancers and singers and whatever would come in, and he would try to place Remick songs for them.
Gershwin was also deeply influenced by the African-American jazz musicians he heard in Harlem, such as stride pianist Lucky Roberts. Kimball says Gershwin went to Roberts for lessons in jazz styling.
Lucky would play for him, he would play for Lucky. They would show each other things, and Lucky was obviously one of his mentors.
I think he reacted in a creative way just to the sound of that music, the way he reacted to the sound of the city or the sound of Yiddish, and he just soaked it up.
Smithsonian cultural historian Amy Henderson says that Gershwin was trying to capture the rhythm, pace, and pulse of New York in the 20s.
Gershwin talked about writing a music for the melting pot, and he thought that from this kind of incredible national diversity would come what he called an artistic unity.
love you, how I love you, my dear old Juani. I'd give the world to be among the folks in Georgia, even though your mammy's waiting for your brain.
By the time he was 21, George Gershwin had an enormous hit with Swanee, which Al Jolson made popular. He soon was hired to write songs for a series of Broadway revues produced by George White. But Gershwin's ambitions extended beyond songwriting. For the 1922 edition of White's Review, Gershwin wrote a one-act opera, Blue Monday, which incorporated elements of jazz.
I must admit, although I don't like Sunday, I have a fit when I go through Blue Monday. Monday's the one day that my dice lose. They just refuse. That's when my cares are always bigger. These cares are always bigger.
The opera flopped, but it was important in Gershwin's development, according to Edward Jablonski.
Musically, it's fascinating. A lot of musical sequences foreshadow Rhapsody in Blue.
Blue Monday marked the first time that Gershwin worked with the famous bandleader Paul Whiteman. Both Whiteman and Gershwin were interested in legitimizing jazz by putting it on the concert stage and thought they might work together in the future on a piano concerto. But both men got busy with other projects. 2 years passed, and Gershwin heard nothing from Whiteman. George's brother Ira recalled in a 1950s interview that Whiteman made plans for a concert but never bothered to tell George.
One day in January 1924, I called George's attention to an item in the music column of a morning paper to the effect that Whiteman was going through with his idea of doing a concert. It was to be at Aeolian Hall, and Whiteman was going to feature a suite by Victor Herbert and also something by George Gershwin.
Biographer Edward Jablonski continues the story.
He said, you know, you're writing a concerto? And George says, what? Gershwin was working on Sweet Little Devil at that time and was not exactly available to turn out a concerto in something like 3 or 4 weeks. And so he called Whiteman the next day and he said, you know, I can't do that. And he said, maybe I'll just do a rhapsody.
A rhapsody, according to Webster's Dictionary, is an instrumental composition of free, irregular form, suggesting improvisation. In an interview in the 50s, Paul Whiteman said,
of course, we all agreed with that because I know that George felt the same as we did, that we didn't want to be bound by symphonic rules, and after all, if you write a rhapsody, you can throw the rules out the window.
Gershwin had only 3 weeks to come up with his piece for Paul Whiteman. He took several themes from his musical notebooks, or tune books as he called them, and sketched out the structure of Rhapsody in Blue on the train to Boston, where Sweet Little Devil was being performed. He wrote out a detailed two-piano version of the score, but one of Whiteman's arrangers, Ferdy Groffé, handled the orchestration.
Gershwin didn't have time to orchestrate, so that's why Groffé did the orchestration. Gershwin, I think, could have if he wanted to, but he didn't have the time to begin with.
Rehearsals began in early February in the Palais Royal, the nightclub where Whiteman's band performed every evening until 2 a.m. Conductor Michael Tilson Thomas, who has recorded the Rhapsody several times, says that at one of these rehearsals, Gershwin and the musicians made an unexpected discovery.
All of the original themes were up-tempo, including ya-da-dee-da, da-dee-da, was originally written by George's ya-ba-ba-ba, ba-ba-ba-ba. It was only by accident they discovered it could be played slowly, and then Ira convinced him that he should keep it.
Even with Ferdy Groffé's orchestral assistance, the Gershwin score wasn't completed by the February 12th premiere. According to Robert Kimball, there were literally blank spaces in the piano part.
Some of the moments in the piece may have just come as he was performing it. Most of it was written down, obviously, but there are spots where he could improvise a little bit, and he could do it because he never played the same piece the same way twice.
That's George Gershwin at the piano with the Whiteman Band in a recording made in 1924. Ira Gershwin recalled the scene at Aeolian Hall the day of the premiere.
There was a traffic jam in front of Aeolian Hall, and everybody of any musical stature in New York had been invited, and many had to be turned away. Rachmaninoff, Heifetz, Elman, Damrosch, Kreisler, all top-flight names in the musical world, remained to applaud and praise the concert.
Rhapsody in Blue was the hit of the afternoon. The audience loved it, but the critical reception was mixed. Lawrence Gilman of the Tribune used adjectives like lifeless, derivative, and stale to describe it, while Deems Taylor of the World was of the opinion that Mr. Gershwin will bear watching. A common criticism of the academics was that the rhapsody was formless. Robert Kimball.
It didn't follow traditional forms very carefully and explicitly. You have these great, great themes. How they are linked together is not necessarily the way it would have been linked by someone like, let's say, Virgil Thompson or Aaron Copland, but it lives. And so many pieces more skillfully written, according to the academics, do not.
Clearly, Rhapsody in Blue has stood the test of time. Gershwin performed it often during his own tragically brief lifetime, and it remains a standard repertory item for symphony orchestras all over the world. There are more than 75 CDs featuring Rhapsody in Blue currently in print. When ASCAP, the music licensing organization, published its list of the 25 most performed works of the 20th century, Rhapsody in Blue was right up there with Happy Birthday and White Christmas. It's become that ingrained in the national consciousness. Pretty astonishing for a piece of music written by a 25-year-old in 3 weeks. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London.
Listening to NPR's Weekend Edition.